This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As we do before every major sporting event, the Only a Game staff sat down earlier this summer to decide how to cover this year's Tour de France. For the past few years, the interviews we had planned with cycling experts about which rider had the edge on the hill climbs and who was likely to dominate in the sprints had degenerated into endless conversations about blood transfusions, testosterone levels, and failed doping controls. We decided that we'd had enough. We would give this year's Tour de France as little attention as possible. We've taken a lot of heat from listeners for that stance, but now that the tour is over, we feel it deserves a postmortem. I mean a wrap-up. Joining me now on the line is Bonnie DeSimone, who covered this year's Tour de Scandal for ESPN.com. Bonnie, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me.
At least three riders, all big names, tested positive during this tour. Two teams went home, and Michael Rasmussen, the holder of the yellow jersey, was kicked out. As the tour wrapped up, one seasoned cycling writer said, "This year's tour could be defined in only one way, an utter fiasco." Would you agree?
Bill, I disagree with that completely. I really am in the perhaps minority of folks that feel that what we're watching is a sport that is maybe not in a perfect way, but trying to clean itself up. And the price for clean sport is heavy. You're going to have stars knocked out. You're going to have competitions that have big holes blown through them. But at least cycling is trying to address the problem.
Despite everything that happened during this tour, more Americans watched the tour on Versus than ever before. More than 20 million people tuned in for some or all of the 23-day race, up from 18 million in 2006. Did those viewers see a race that was worth watching?
Well, you make an interesting point, Bill. I wondered aloud in one of my columns whether perhaps doping bus had become the equivalent of NASCAR crashes and people are sort of waiting to see who gets kicked out next. I think the tour is always going to be a great telegenic event. It's a beautiful event. If you just take away all of the controversy, then I do think this was a really wide-open tour that was going to make a new star, probably. I'm a little surprised by the numbers. I'm surprised in this country at the numbers, but I think it just goes to show that there was a base created during the Lance Armstrong years that is not going to go away soon.
And competition is competition. When you get a great finish, some people would say that's what you need to get a great race.
This was a bizarre one, though. I mean, to have the race, essentially the standings, decapitated 4 days before the end of the race, there was almost a huge reshuffling, but in the end, things stayed the same, and Contador won. Cadel Evans from Australia finished second, and Levi Leipheimer was third.
Tour de France organizers have thus far only attempted to excise the names of two winners, Bjarne Riis in 1996 and Floyd Landis last year, but many of the men who joined Riis and Landis on the podium have also been implicated in various doping scandals. How did tour organizers decide who got an asterisk and who didn't?
Well, Bill, you're hitting on a pet peeve of mine. The answer is that their decisions are being made piecemeal, and I think in a rather irrational way. My feeling is that you can't just scrub people out of the record books. If you want to add material saying Bjarne Riis won in 1996, 10 years later or 11 years later confessed to having doped during his career, add that to the history book. Don't erase it from the history book, because you're just going to wind up with, as you point out, a lot of contradictions, a lot of basically hypocrisy.
Cycling fans have been writing to me saying that if baseball or football were to test as often as cycling tests, just as many cheaters would be caught. I suppose one way to interpret the number of positive tests in this tour would be to see it as a sign that the doping controls are working better than they used to. Cheaters are being caught and punished. How much of the surge in doping positives comes from the fact that testers are now looking harder for the cheaters and using better tools in their search?
There's no question that that's a factor. There's a woman, she is now in charge of anti-doping policy, essentially. Her name is Ann Gripper. And one of the things she said this spring is, hey, we're not just going to do random tests anymore. We are going to target test riders that we believe are exhibiting suspicious activity. So there's no question I think that's going to make a difference in the scores, so to speak. And on your other point, who knows? I mean, it's all a matter of speculation to say that there's as much doping going on in football or baseball or any other sport. What I do believe is that what the Tour de France brought to the forefront is that all of us, and that's journalists and fans and people in the industry and athletes, we all have to decide what we prefer, because when we try to have clean sport, as we saw in the Tour just now, it's very messy. For example, the Rasmussen controversy and the way he was forced out of the race when he was in the lead 5 days before the end, you would have to compare that to a baseball pitcher for a World Series team thrown out before his Game 7 start.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're serious about wanting clean sport, you have to accept the possibility that that might happen.
Before this year's race even began, there was bad blood between UCI, the sport's international governing body, and the organizers of the tour. If these two organizations split, that can't be good for the sport.
No, you've hit really what I would consider to be almost as grave a threat to the sport as doping itself. The dysfunctionality of the bureaucracies and the organizations that run the sport. I mean, honestly, during the tour, what appeared to be happening was that the UCI and the ASO, which is the parent company that owns the tour, were using doping as a bludgeon to hit each other over the head rather than presenting a united front and saying this is a scourge and we want to get rid of it. And it's really a typical sad story of ego and turf wars. And if it doesn't get solved, I honestly believe that that would be something that would turn sponsors off more than doping itself, because if you've got people trying to knife each other in the back, then the long-term future of your sport is not rosy.
Bonnie DeSimone covered the Tour de France for ESPN.com. Bonnie, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
The Indiana Fever started the 2007 WNBA season by going 16-4. Then star forward Tamika Catchings injured her foot and the team lost 6 of their last 7 games. Coincidence? Definitely not. Although the Fever, who are currently the Eastern Conference's second-best team, can imagine a title run without her. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Marianne Holland recently caught up with the Fever, which hopes to earn their first ever WNBA championship this year.
It's late July, and the Indiana Fever is having its first practice at Conseco Fieldhouse after a 3-game road losing streak without leading scorer Tamika Catchings. Catch, as she's known to her teammates, shoots hoops alone at one end of the court while her team works on defensive strategy.
You know, I hate sitting on the bench and watching, but, you know, one of the things that that I know this team, we're good enough as a team that we should be able to get through this and come out with a whole bunch of wins.
But that hasn't been the case. The Fever went on to suffer a 6-game losing streak before Tuesday's win against the Washington Mystics. Before Catching's foot injury, the Indiana Fever was considered one of the hottest teams in the WNBA, posting 16 wins. Forward Tamika Whitmore says being a league favorite can be tough.
People don't realize the pressure that you feel when you're sitting on top and you got that big target on your back and everybody's out to get you. Not only that, but everybody's expectations are for you to win a championship, and that's a lot of pressure. But one thing I've learned throughout my basketball experience is that when it's crunch time, I tend to perform a lot better.
Lucky for the Fever, that's been the case. Whitmore tallied a career-high 15 rebounds in Tuesday night's win. While Catchings has led the team in points, assists, and rebounds for much of the season, the Fever is considered one of the deepest teams in the league. Tan White, Cherise Sam, Anna DeForge, and Tammy Sutton Brown have all been strong players. So has Australian Tully Bevilacqua, who helped the Seattle Storm to a league title in 2004.
With having that depth in the team, it has brought about a confidence that we know that we are good. We can be good, we can be better, and we have all the players to win that championship. So I think it's also, you know, had a ripple effect on our confidence as well, in a positive way.
Indiana Fever assistant coach Lynn Dunn agrees. She's coached at the collegiate and professional levels for 37 years and says the team's success will depend on its adaptability.
We've got to go through a process now where roles are changed and different people have to provide different things. And we've got to still continue, though, to stay focused on what our goals are, and that's a championship without Tamika. And then when she comes back, I think we could potentially be even better because everybody else has had to raise their game, do a little bit more in a lot of areas.
During a recent home game between the Fever and the San Antonio Silver Stars, fan Clifford Massey sat in the stands with his pregnant wife and three kids. The family is new to the world of women's pro basketball. Massey says he won the tickets to the first game, but he and his family had a good time, so they came back. He says he hopes the Fever can bring Indiana its first professional basketball championship since the early 1970s, when the Pacers dominated the American Basketball Association.
I think that their chances are real good. From what I hear, they have one of the best defensive teams in the league, so defense wins games. I think it would be very exciting, and also I think it would tell the Pacers to get on their job.
Head coach Brian Winters says while a championship for the Fever would be nice, it would be nicer if the Pacers, the Fever's NBA counterpart, could share in the success.
I'd much rather have it that the Pacers are doing well and we're doing well. I would rather have it that way. I think that's good for everybody who works here, your whole organization, Pacers and Fever. And so in my mind, it's not good that the Pacers are down and we're up, or they're good and we're down. I think it's the best of all worlds is for us to both be good.
The Indiana Fever has less than 10 regular season games before the playoffs began on August 23rd. With star player Tamika Catchings off the court indefinitely, even her teammates may not be sure of their chances at a WNBA championship. Still, in Indiana, the land known as much for its basketball as for its cornfields, a WNBA title would be the perfect trophy for the Fever to bring home. For Only a Game, I'm Marianne Holland in Indianapolis.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Neil Thompson, author of Hurricane Season, A Coach, His Team, and Their Triumph in the Time of Katrina. But first, each summer, some of the best young golfers in the U.S. travel around the country to play in tournaments run by the American Junior Golf Association. At one such tournament, at the Tedesco Country Club in Marblehead, Massachusetts last month, Monday, the practice day, was marred by rain for everyone except 17-year-old Sarah Jackson, who has a history of performing well in bad weather.
Yeah, I am a mutter. I really am. That's what my dad calls me.
Sarah's dad plays to a 10 handicap, meaning he shoots in the low 80s. I asked Sarah, whose handicap is 4, when she had first beaten him.
Oh, my God. Probably like 3 years ago.
So you were how old?
I was 14, probably 13 to 14.
Maybe it was raining that day too, at least for Dad. Her early success hasn't convinced Sarah Jackson that she wants to play golf for a living. In fact, she thinks she might want to be a high school math teacher, which perhaps explains why she's still living in the Northeast, unlike some of those against whom she was competing.
We from New Jersey, but about a year and a half, we moved down to Florida in Orlando. Lake Mary, actually. Lake Mary, which is outside of Orlando.
Lena Pock is the mother of 16-year-old Isabel Hahn, on whose behalf the family relocated.
It wasn't easy. We thought about it and rethought about it. But then she's the one who wanted it. She said, okay, I'm very serious now with golf. She wanted to play all year round. And she said, eventually, she wants to become a professional golfer.
Isabel, who celebrated her 16th birthday last Wednesday, is in no hurry to turn pro. She wants to go to college, though she won't knock her peers who've tried competing on the LPGA Tour as teenagers.
I mean, that's great for those players. They're very talented, but I mean, anything can happen. You know, you can get hurt, you know, by accidents. So I mean, education is just always there, just in case you don't, you know, as long as you don't hurt your brain, then you're set.
So higher education is in the picture for Isabel, but that picture is still a little fuzzy.
Well, actually, UCLA sent me a letter and a questionnaire. They sent it to me my sophomore year, so they couldn't formally recruit me until next year when I turned junior. I want to go to Duke because they have a great golf team, and I guess Duke and UCLA, those are my one and two.
Not going to stay in Florida.
Well, I want to stay close to Florida because my teacher's there. I don't want to go all the way to California. Well, it is in California. Oops. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Find another teacher.
Or maybe we'll just fly back. Whatever happens, God knows.
Isabel Hahn can laugh about whatever might happen next, especially as she has already attracted the attention of at least one golf coach. But for the coaches, there's no giggling at a tournament like the one in Marblehead.
This is a worthwhile trip. I came here for a specific purpose. I had a chance to see what I came to see. I'm going to see it again tomorrow.
That's Sue Nias, the women's golf coach at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. And though she was willing to tell me she'd come to Marblehead to see one particular golfer, Nias wouldn't tell me who that golfer was.
Because if I do, then I violate the NCAA rules.
Seated under an umbrella at the first tee, Sue Nias watched the juniors hit their drives and then trudge into the drizzle and mist. Coach Nias wears a BYU jacket to the tournaments and a BYU visor, so though she cannot talk to the players, they cannot fail to know the BYU coach is watching. The NCAA also forbids Nias from calling potential players, although they are allowed to call her. All the rules are set up to protect the student-athletes from the vicious coaches, Nias says. Assuming that this would be a frustrating circumstance, and given that the coach had already acknowledged that she comes to these tournaments dressed, in her words, like a placard, I suggested that maybe she should wear her phone number on the back of her BYU jacket, the way caddies at the Masters wear on their backs the names of the golfers whose bags they're carrying.
That's a good idea. I carry my cards, but no, I'll do that. I'm going to start putting my phone number up. That's a great idea. I like that.
So if the Brigham Young women's golf team suddenly gets great, you'll know where the triumph began. Sue Nias says she can spot talent in a golfer who's half a dozen years shy of becoming a freshman.
Well, they could be very young. If they've got some potential, it's pretty apparent, even if they're, you know, 12 or 13 years old. You see athletic ability. You see a person who's got balance and who can swing the golf club.
Can you tell anything about competitive nature at that age?
You can. And the other thing that's really important is you see how they treat their parents. If they're treating their parents well, then likely you'll be treated well. And if they don't treat their parents very well, or they're yelling at their dad who's on the bag, or you know, they're having family fights about the golf, then you know that maybe that's not where you want to go. So there's a lot to be gleaned from watching them play in these little events.
Of course, these events are not so little for the players. They haven't all relocated to find better teachers and a climate more hospitable to year-round golf. But according to Evan Harmeling, who'll attend Princeton in the fall and play golf there, a lot of the young men playing in Marblehead see themselves as future touring pros.
I'd say more than you'd think. I'd say maybe close to, like in a tournament like this, of 80 kids or whatever, 80 guys, maybe 30 or 40, like, at least want to. And I think maybe 10 or 15 think they have, like, actually believe that they have a chance. So that's a pretty high number.
Harmeling faced more pressure than some of the other competitors. His family lives in Reading, Massachusetts, just down the interstate from Marblehead, though he tried not to let that affect his approach to the tournament.
I'd be happy with anything in the top, probably 5 or 10. I mean, obviously I want to win it, and I'm not going to be completely happy if I don't, but I'm not going to be mad if I go out there and shoot like 85, 86, something like that. But, I mean, I won't get too worked up about it.
In fact, Evan Harmeling shot an exceptionally efficient 68 during the final round of the Tedesco Country Club event, but that was not good enough to lift him into the top 10. Isabel Hahn improved each day of the tournament, turning in rounds of 80, 77, and 74. She finished second. The top juniors will next gather on Monday in Village of Pinehurst, North Carolina, for the Golf Pride Junior Classic. except for the ones who'll be at the tournament at the Rivercut Golf Course in Springfield, Missouri, or the Smithfield Junior Championship in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Gee, for these kids, returning to school is going to feel like a vacation.
Hitting it up, hitting it out, hitting it long, hitting it hard. Yeah, that's what it's all about. I can bogey like Bacall, I can birdie big or small. I'm an eagle after all, so watch my score fall. There's a tiger in the woods and he's lying on the green. Golden bears on the fairway with a dogleg in between. It's a wildlife and a struggle for survival.
John Curtis, the man who began the John Curtis Christian School in New Orleans 45 years ago, was unapologetic about his school's most obvious distinction. When people complained that the John Curtis School specialized in producing football players, John Curtis himself would say, "We're the Rolls-Royce of athletic factories." Winners of a score of state championships, the private school, its football players, and its coach, JT, son of John Curtis, faced the same challenge millions of others faced in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. How do we put our lives back together? In Hurricane Season, subtitled A Coach, His Team, and Their Triumph in the Time of Katrina, Neil Thompson tells the story of the team's 2005 season. Neil Thompson joins me now from Greenville, South Carolina. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here.
And we're also joined by J.T. Curtis, the head coach of the football team at John Curtis. Coach, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill. Looking forward to the opportunity to visit with you.
Me too. Neil, you write that as the residents of New Orleans were being warned that Katrina was likely to clobber the city and they were being told they should be evacuating, Coach Curtis and his assistants were really more worried about the next football game than they were about the storm when one of the coaches takes a phone call from his wife, who's very frightened, says, "Should I be making hotel reservations?" And he says, "Why are you bothering me with silly questions? We're practicing." Didn't this sort of behavior strike you as, at best, thoughtless and maybe even irresponsible?
I guess at first glance it could seem that way, and that might have been my first reaction. But I think the more research I did and the more I got to know not only the coaches and the players but their parents, and also learned, too, a little bit more about New Orleans and its culture, I realized that that was the reaction a lot of people had. Here we go again, you know, another big warning that's going to probably, excuse me, end up being nothing. Because over the years, the city has been threatened time and time again by potentially dangerous hurricanes that at the last minute have veered off and or petered out or you know, just dissipated. So I describe in the book how a lot of citizens of the city are kind of jaded by hurricane warnings, and they weren't too terribly terrified of this one at the start. The book starts on a Friday, and as the weekend progresses, people realize that this is indeed the one that they've been warning about for years. But when the book starts on Friday night, yeah, the team, all they really care about is that first football game that they play that night and getting back to practice the next day.
Coach Curtis, you did have to evacuate. Your family had to leave New Orleans, as did many, many thousands of people. When you were able to get back to New Orleans and get back to the school in the aftermath of the storm, what did you find?
You know, what a lot of people don't realize is that no one was allowed back into the city for almost 2 weeks. And water sat in people's homes and in their houses for 2 weeks, and that is what causes a great deal of destruction in our area. But we were very fortunate. Neil does a great job in the book telling a story about us getting to come back in as janitors with a service master organization to clean up the buildings for the power and light companies in our area. When we did that, we were able to get in, and we were able to find our school, and we were able to recognize that we had not suffered any flood damage. And we thought that we could get our school back together when all we were hearing on the national media and even in the local media, although that wasn't very much because they were all out of commission, was, "You're not coming back to this city for 6 months. You're not getting back in this city for 9 months. This thing is polluted. It's underwater. It's not going to drain." And we realized that there was a possibility we could come back. And once we did, we decided that if we could, we should.
Neil, how important to the people in Louisiana was the resumption of high school football, not only at John Curtis, but across the state?
I think it took on a much greater importance during the 2005 season than it might have otherwise. I mean, football is already an important part of everybody's life in Louisiana. It's a pretty sports-obsessed state. But after Katrina, you got kids who were terribly, terribly affected by the storm, who lost their homes, who were living in FEMA trailers, were in shelters or with relatives. But even the families who didn't lose their homes, their lives were upended as well. I can't tell you how many kids I talked to at the school who said that during that period, all they wanted was normalcy. I want some normalcy back in my life. And so a lot of kids and their families latched on to those Friday night games. And one of the moms I talked to who lost her home and her business, she owned a daycare business in town, mother of one of the players named Tank English, she said those Friday night games, that's what kept me going. You know, she looked forward to them all week long, and it was the highlight of her week. Because during the week, she's arguing with insurance agents and FEMA officials and, you know, trying to figure out where she's going to live and what to do about her ruined home. And then she's got this spectacle to look forward to on Friday night where everything is the way it should be.
Coach, you had lost one star player to another school before the storm, a kid who had transferred for various reasons, and it looked as if some of your other players might not be returning to John Curtis, given that their homes had been destroyed, in some cases their parents had found work somewhere else. What were your first thoughts about trying to reassemble a team under those circumstances?
Well, the first issue was a young man that transferred decided he wanted to be the man, and I don't have the man on the team. So he left, and we wished him well, and that was difficult enough. And then when we realized that they were telling people we might not be able to get back, it was a lump in your throat, because you have to understand that we are a private school. We're strictly a tuition-based school, and if we don't have students, we don't have a school. We don't have the means to support ourselves. So we started getting on the phones, and we started text messaging people. We got up on a website that our team used out of California called eTeams, and we put information on that to say, we're coming back. Just hang in there. And that word spread, and when we decided and called our first practice 3.5 weeks after Katrina and got there nervously waiting for the first arrival, and it seemed like it took him all day to get there, and when he got there, it seemed like it took another 2 hours for the next guy to come. But we started that first practice with about 40 guys, which was about 60% less than what we normally had, and we were able to move forward from there.
My guests are Neil Thompson, author of Hurricane Season, and J.T. Curtis, coach of the Curtis Christian School Patriots. You're listening to Only a Game. A couple of your players ended up living with you and your family. In what ways did this arrangement complicate your role as a coach, and how did the families of those players feel about their sons moving in with you?
Believe it or not, they were elated. You know, in Jonathan English, one of the young men that lived with me, he told his mom, he said, Mom, I can't go anyplace else. I've been going to Curtis since I was in kindergarten. I'm not going anyplace else. So she called me and she says, Coach, can you help me? And I said, Jonathan can stay with me. And so Jonathan moved in with me, and his mother found a small house that she and her two sisters and her elderly brother had to live in. And when after Jonathan had been with us for about 3 months, Jonathan walked into the house, and he looked at his mom, and he said, Mom, if you don't mind, I'm going to keep living with Coach if he'll have me. He said, this place is too small. And he was exactly right. And our story wasn't unique. There were many, many, many families that were helping other people and staying with them.
Coach, tell me a little bit about how things stand now. Have you still got players and students there whose families are living in trailers and sort of still waiting for the kind of basic help?
Oh, numerous. You can pass down the streets of New Orleans in certain areas, and the streets are lined with FEMA trailers. One of my young men just got back into his house a week ago. And I'm talking about a middle-class family that both mom and dad work. Dad has an insurance business, and it's just been so difficult to get people that can do the work that needs to be done. And understand that part of that is because of the massiveness of the destruction. It's not a few hundred homes, it's thousands of homes that have been destroyed. So, yes, to answer your question, there are still people that are living with other people and traveling back and forth in the evening to try to work on their homes. Now, there's still a tremendous struggle that's going on in the greater New Orleans area.
J.T. Curtis is the coach of the football team at John Curtis Christian School for students K-12 in New Orleans. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
You have no idea what a pleasure it was for us to do it, and we appreciate you giving us the opportunity to keep people aware of our city and its great needs.
And Neil Thompson is the author of Hurricane Season, A Coach, His Team, and Their Triumph in the Time of Katrina, published by Free Press. He joined me from Greenville, South Carolina. Neil, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was a real pleasure to be with you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, our renegade reporter on wheels digs up some dirt on, well, on a dirt bike. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Boston Celtics got better this week, eh?
Well, they managed to put together a really tremendous marketing program for the 2007-2008 season. They will sell a lot of tickets. They will be spoken about on the radio. They will make the back page of the local tabloid and the front page of the local broadsheet sports sections. They also have, absent Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, and Paul Pierce, the worst roster in the NBA by a factor of about 10. So they will be relevant. They will draw a lot of interest. They will be fun to watch. They will win more games. But people are getting awfully giddy over a team that has utterly no bench at this point.
Well, this giddiness is perhaps the point. Commissioner Stern is certainly hoping that trading Kevin Garnett will distract people from last week's big NBA story. Any chance that that will happen?
Well, it did for a while, but that, unfortunately, the thing with legal cases is they go on and on and on and on. The Tim Donaghy scandal got bigger. A gambler named Peter Ruggieri, who talked to the FBI, said he noticed things were a little fishy, making him the world's smartest gambler. And the operator of a sports bar outside of Philly is apparently going to be indicted in connection with the same thing. So this thing just keeps metastasizing at the heart of the game.
Some cite the signings of Garnett, Zach Randolph, and Rashard Lewis to the Celtics, Knicks, and Magic, respectively, as proof that the NBA's Eastern Conference is finally catching up with the West. You go along with that?
Well, they've become more interesting. It's a more offensively-minded conference now. The Celtics are going to outscore people because they, frankly, put together a really bad defensive team. If the big guy in Miami decides he wants a last hurrah and gets in shape, that's a very good offensive team. Certainly the Wizards and even the Knicks have the potential to be that, as do the Bulls. So, yes, I think that the running Western Conference has a little bit of a challenge now from the guys in the East, everybody except Detroit.
On Monday, Bill Walsh died. He was 75 years old, and among his achievements was turning a bad San Francisco 49ers team into a Super Bowl winner over the course of just 3 years. A lot of people know about that. Fewer know that he once successfully impersonated a bellboy. Yeah,
apparently, at the first Super Bowl, which took place in Pontiac, Michigan, the first Super Bowl that his 49ers went to, apparently he put a bellman's uniform on and started collecting people's bags at the curb and briefly got into a little bit of a tussle with Joe Montana, who when Walsh tried to take his briefcase. Now, my question, beyond the fact that who knew Bill Walsh as baggy pants comedian, is what did Joe Montana possibly have in a briefcase?
I can't get out of my head the image of Vince Lombardi doing this. It just wouldn't have happened.
Well, as we know from David Marinus's book, Vince used to dress up in priest's robes and mime the performance of the mask.
Yes.
But at least he did that in private.
Were you surprised to learn that, yes, the cable network that shows New York Yankees games is now for sale?
I was, actually, and it's an indication, I think, more than anything else, that George Steinbrenner is failing, as has been rumored. You know, to split the YES Network away from the Yankees is something I don't think he would have done, but I think people are positioning themselves, particularly his heirs apparent, for the post-George Steinbrenner era in New York.
The Dodgers held a steroids awareness clinic on Thursday night before their game against, wait for it, the Giants. I'm sure this was completely coincidental.
That's what the Dodgers spokesman said. It was a complete coincidence. Who knew Barry was coming? They only made the schedule out a year ago.
The Chicago Cubs slipped into first place on Wednesday, Charlie, and their manager, Lou Piniella, cautioned against excessive optimism. I wonder if that was really necessary.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the idea of Lou Piniella cautioning anyone for being overly emotional about anything is pretty hilarious. Of course, they went in there at the expense of the plucky Milwaukee Brewers, who fell into second place, and manager Ned Yost and a couple of his players started tangling, which, by the way, is exactly when the Cubs turned their season around, when two of their players got in a fight. So maybe that's the way to do it.
Last week, we marveled at the scandals rocking the sports world, and now we may have another one, this one involving tennis. What's this all about?
Yes, an ATP tournament in Poland. Now, you would wonder, you know, why there would be anybody would care about this, but we are living in the globalized, internet-connected age.
Simple answer,
and
money.
A British online gambling company killed all the bets. A match between Nikolai Davidenko, who was number 4 ranked, and the number 87 ranked Martin Vassallo Arguello of Argentina. All of a sudden, Betfair got $7 million in bets on the match, which is 10 times the usual amount. And they kept coming in even after Davidenko won the first set.
And they were
now,
betting on the
I'm
other guy.
I'm not Damon Runyon, okay? But if the money still comes on the guy when he's behind, I'm staying away from the favorite.
Former Dallas Maverick Roy Tarpley scored a legal victory this week when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission ruled that the NBA violated the Americans with Disabilities Act when it banned him from the league back in 1995 for violating the league's substance abuse policy. Do you think this will set a precedent and undermine efforts of sports governing bodies to crack down on substance abuse?
Well, it's interesting. It may submarine their policies against recreational drugs. Roy Tarpley's problem, of course, was with cocaine. And we've all, you know, the steroid hysteria has been such that it's drowned out all this other stuff. But under the law, drug addiction is a disability. And you cannot discriminate somebody based on a disability. So this does put the recreational pharmaceutical piece of anti-drug programs in professional sports under a very interesting microscope now.
Yeah, and, you know, regardless of what happens in the future, does everybody else who's ever been banned from any league now suddenly have a case?
Well, presumably if they've been clean since then. Yeah, because obviously if they've continued to use drugs and they keep testing positive, the clock starts again. But by all accounts, Tarpley has been clean since he was banned. And the EEOC, under an administration which is not a big fan of the EEOC, is behind him.
Iraq's national soccer team captured the Asian Cup Sunday in Jakarta. This really does rank as one of the best upsets in recent times.
Absent all the incredible extraneous factors going on around the Iraqi team, this was an amazing upset by a team. The Saudis are far and away the best soccer team in that area. I know because when I was there in Qatar years ago for the Asian Zone qualifying, they were far and away better than Japan. They were better than South Korea. And for the Iraqis to come together and beat these guys is just an astonishing feat of athletic achievement, if nothing else. And I have to admit, I got to love any team that's called the Lions of the Two Rivers.
History is in the making at St. Andrews this week, Charlie, as the Women's British Open is ongoing there. Shall we raise a pint to celebrate the occasion?
First time women's professional golf has played the old course. This is one of the last barriers left, the one unassailable parapet, of course, being the one in Augusta, Georgia.
And finally, Charlie, we have another world record to
one
celebrate.
A week now.
Would you please do the honors?
A Tasmanian fellow beat the world static cycling record. In other words, he took 111 hours, 11 minutes, 11 seconds to go absolutely nowhere. And apparently has taken the record and thrown it way far ahead of a lot of other people who are pursuing the record without going anywhere at all.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Clouds so swift, rain won't lift, gate won't close, feelings froze. Get your mind off winter time. You ain't going nowhere.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. At last summer's X Games, a young motorcycle rider named Travis Pastrana won gold when he threw a double back flip, a trick a few riders had unsuccessfully attempted in competition. It's hard to imagine what Travis Pastrana might come up with at this summer's X Games, now underway in Los Angeles, but watching him ride can make you wonder just how fearless a person has to be to fly upside down 50 feet in the air and safely land a motorcycle. Arizona Public Radio's Jillian Ferris-Cole decided to find out.
23-year-old Travis Pastrana says he was only landing the double backflip about 50% of the time when he decided to try it out at last year's X Games.
If you mess it up, it's bad. Once they moved the ramp back, the crowd was on their feet, and I'm like, oh, boy. Basically convinced myself that, you know, I knew that I'd done the training, I knew that I'd done the preparation, and I knew that if I just committed to it and didn't panic, it probably was going to work out.
But wipeouts are part of Pastrana's daily schedule. He says he falls hard at least twice a day. Innovations in the sport have made learning new tricks a little bit easier. Pastrana and other riders practice stunts into a giant pit filled with foam blocks. But Pastrana says it's no cushy landing and no substitute for dirt.
I mean, a pit hurts. You land, you come to a dead stop. You're usually stuck at the bottom of a 10-foot pit, wedged in some very awkward position with a 220-pound motorcycle over your head, and, you know, it's usually dripping gas. There's no possible way to even move.
Pastrana is currently one of the most decorated motocross champions on the planet. He grew up in a family of dirt bike enthusiasts. Even his mom can throw a single backflip into the foam pit.
When I was 4 years old, I was begging for a motorcycle, and basically Santa Claus brought it for right after I turned four for Christmas. And that was pretty much it. I mean, you know, my family and I are so close because of the sport.
But for those of us who didn't grow up in a full-throttle family, Pastrana says dirt bike school is a good idea.
Right away, if you know, especially for kids or you know, even adults, you know, go to a school, learn just a little bit about proper riding technique, a little bit about how to use the throttle and the clutch while you're young, nimble, able to kind of, you know, you start on slower bikes and, you know, you're going to take a few spills along the way, but I found that the kids that start when they're young are much safer and better controlled riders.
There are dozens of motorcycle and dirt bike training schools across the country. Some of them are in Arizona, a dirt biking mecca with thousands of miles of dusty roads to explore. When I tell Travis Pastrana that I get to go to dirt bike school as part of my research for this story, he says he'll pray for me. The campus of the Arizona Dirt Bike School in Glendale consists of a small office in the middle of a giant parking lot. It's divided into different areas where students learn how to ride street motorcycles for the first time or learn more advanced techniques.
The further ahead you look, the more balance you have.
There's also a dirt track, a school of sorts, strewn with orange pylons and surrounded by a small embankment.
There you go, good. Look all the way through the corner, all the way through.
Eric Noyes and Kurt Crenshaw are dirt bike instructors. Tonight they have three pupils, all women, and we sit together under a white umbrella by the track. It's just before sunset, but it's still 100 degrees. Disappointingly, Eric starts with bookwork, not wheelies.
If you want to know something about a motorcycle,
motorcycle operator's manual, or your second mom, the first set of initials that'll be on the written test later. You guys want a written test?
We learn about checking fuel levels and brake cables. Eric and Kurt show us basic hand signals to use on the trails, since you can't hear a thing over four-stroke motors. We also receive our school uniforms. Helmets, gloves, and goggles.
Yeah, and some of those helmets probably aren't in the right boxes. They've just been thrown back in there by various people.
This is too big for me.
We've got an extra large.
Oh, in the medium box, that's good.
Yeah, there you go. We tricked you.
My sister students are a tiny mother and daughter duo, 18-year-old Cassie and 51-year-old Hannah Nguyen. Hannah says they're taking the class because the whole family is going on an overseas motorcycle tour and nobody knows how to ride yet.
We originally from Vietnam. And we thought that riding along Ho Chi Minh Trail would be a cool thing to do. I thought I would be a passenger with my husband riding me. Now I find out that I'm not allowed to be a passenger. He thinks he knows how to ride a mountain bike. I find out next week.
Down on the track, all geared up, we're finally allowed to throw our legs over the dirt bikes. Eric and Kurt show us how to walk the bikes forward and backward in neutral and use the brakes. Only then can we turn over the motors.
So to start this one, all you do is reach up, push this button with your thumb. Let go.
count to the count of three or four, what we'll do is we'll help it warm up a little bit.
We take baby steps, learning how to put the bikes in gear and get a good mix of clutch and throttle. We follow Eric around the small track, first one direction, then the other. Kurt yells out instructions as we work up to second gear, practice standing up, and take turns weaving through pylons. Kurt says he sees all kinds of students, from the coordination impaired to kids with big dreams of superstardom.
When you get a class of new people, they're true beginners, they have only bicycling experience. There are some people who are not cut out for dirt bikes, and that's a tough thing. I've had little guys cry, I've had women cry. I don't like making people cry.
Instructor Eric Noyes says, as with most sports, starting out young is the key to building confidence and coordination.
My daughter's been riding since she was four, and she's eight now. My son's, he's on little training wheels, you know. But I just ride with him. I sit on the back with him, and I just show him how to work the throttle and the brakes and that kind of thing, and just get him used to that. He's actually got very good throttle control.
Our final test on the track is to traverse the embankments. It's only about a 20% grade, but to a beginner, it feels like ascending Mount Everest. But we all make it, and that means we all graduate.
All right, now we have the official certificate. Look at that. Nicely done. Look at that. Is that official or what? You guys are official dirt bike riders. Can you believe that? Yeah.
As a graduation gift, Eric and Kurt arranged to take me on a sunrise ride the next day through the Tonto National Forest, acres of thick desert terrain full of spiny cacti and sandy washes. Dawn brings a dozen riders to the Wildcat trailhead. They speed up and down hills and launch off jumps. Today's crowd is made up mostly of families. Just like Travis Pastrana, 50-year-old Curtis Sapanchez says for him, dirt biking is a family affair.
Oh, it's wonderful to see your kid develop. You know, you're riding behind him, and I really can't explain the feeling. It's really neat. You see him like, okay, he was having a hard time with this, and now look at him. Look at him go, man. And he's standing up on the pegs, and he's got his aggressive attitude and stance going on, and he's tackling some hill, and you're going, wow, look at my kid. It's a cool thing.
Mercifully, my instructors wait until everyone leaves the staging area before they set me free on my Honda 150. So, armed with a helmet, a full tank of gas, and the prayers of a world champion, I head off into the desert in first gear. For Only a Game, I'm Jillian Ferris Cole in the Tonto National Forest.
As we gathered round, we saw the world and we're on our way. Now it's brainwashing dirt bike, ground shaking dirt bike, mind bending dirt bike, and control.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ben Singer. Special thanks to George Hicks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from 17-year-old junior golfer Sarah Jackson, who aspires to be a math teacher. I asked her if she wanted to work with little kids.
Teenagers, I'd actually say. I actually don't like little kids.
Well, yeah, probably because one of those tiny tykes might shoot a 64 this weekend, and you'd feel pretty old at 17. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR.